The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Frisch, Judge Reyes, Judge Kirk, the Honorable Jennifer L. Frisch presiding.
All right. Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is November 30, 2022. This is the third of six cases on our calendar, 822-0810, Kenoria versus State of Minnesota. Counsel, you'll each have 15 minutes for your primary argument. Appellant has an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. I ask that you state your name and your client's name before you begin speaking. Let us know how you'd like us to reference you. This matter is being recorded, as I stated. There are no other recordings permitted. Counsel, with that, you may proceed.
Good morning. My name is Zach Longsdorf. I represent appellant Jeremy Kenoyer. In denying the Kohlhoff-based claims as time-barred, the district court relied primarily on a determination that the evidence Mr. Kenoyer presented was something he knew or should have known about at the time of trial, and therefore it was not newly discovered evidence. Mr. Kenoyer contends that the proper analysis is whether he has exercised diligence rising to the level of due diligence while continuously incarcerated and relying on counsel in discovering that Kohlhoff, who has stated he kept to himself and assumed people would come to him if he was needed, had evidence which showed Kenoyer was not even home when the assault is alleged to have occurred.
Mr. Longstorff, if I could stop you there, I just want to back up a little bit. And it sounds like you're referencing the NAFLA bar standard in terms of knew or should have known. And I just want to make sure that we're clear. I think that the post-conviction court was actually referencing the statutory time bar, the two-year statutory time bar. And I just want to make sure we're on the same page. I think you acknowledge that the two-year statutory time bar actually applies here, but it seems to me that you're arguing that one of two exceptions to that statutory time bar applies, one being the newly discovered evidence and the interest of justice. Is that a fair statement?
That is correct.
Okay. I just want to be clear. Thank you very much.
And I do think that the NAFLA bar and the due diligence prong of the newly discovered evidence exception sort of dovetail together, and they're both a question of what a defendant knew or should have known and whether the exercise of due diligence would have resulted in this evidence.
Sorry to interrupt again, but just to be clear, I think the NAFLA bar, from my reading of the decision by the post-conviction court in the case law, I think that the NAFLA bar goes more to the ineffective assistance of trial counsel and ineffective assistance of appellate counsel claims. We can certainly talk about that, but I actually wanted to talk about the newly discovered evidence exception to the two-year statutory time bar on the claims. There are five requirements that need to be met, and all five need to be met. And to your credit, you acknowledge a couple times in your brief that the newly discovered evidence certainly does impeach AD. And I think that's a fair statement of what you said in your brief, correct?
We do acknowledge that it does impeach, but also that's not the only probative value that the Kohlhoff evidence would have.
And I certainly understand and appreciate that argument, but those five requirements, each and every single one has to be met. And one of them is that it cannot be for impeachment, but if it is indeed for impeachment purposes, then it seems that the newly discovered evidence exception to the statutory time bar cannot apply then.
I would agree with that statement if the only thing that the evidence did was impeach AD. And I think that the way I think about it is if the evidence is merely impeaching, then you can't satisfy the exception to the time bar. But this evidence, I think, does have probative value beyond that. We're looking at a situation
Right. But I, and like I said, I understand the other arguments that you make, but the way that this is written and the way case law has applied it, including in the Riley v. State case from the Minnesota Supreme Court in 2012, that the post-conviction court cited, each one of those elements, each one of those requirements has to be met. And if any one is not met, then it does not fit into that exception. So if it is if one of the ways it can be used is to impeach testimony, then it doesn't qualify for the exception. So I guess my question is, are you aware of any case law that would contradict or is contrary to the Riley case and its progeny?
I'm not aware of any case law that says anything other than all five prongs of this test must be satisfied in order to satisfy that exception to the time bar. But I do think that it's too narrow of a reading of the requirement to say, well, if this evidence does impeach somebody who testified, that automatically means that the time bar exception can't be satisfied. Because when I'm thinking about the admissibility of this evidence, certainly it impeaches AD about several things, including who was home, whether her brothers were there, whether there were five other people already home during this entire afternoon. But we also have a situation where Kohlhoff isn't just impeaching her in a classic sense where we might be using her prior statements, you know, that are inconsistent to impeach her credibility, but Kohlhoff is also making statements based on his own observations. He's saying, look, I was home, I was there, I know who was home, I know who wasn't, I know that AD and her brothers were home, I know that my sister Janelle and Barney were home and their kids, and I know that my brother Jeremy was not. And in this case, we have sort of a unique situation where there's only about 45 minutes where Mr. Knoyer was away from SD that afternoon.
And Mr. Longstorff, why isn't this testimony cumulative of all the other testimony? It seems to be cumulative of the testimony of appellant's mother, of appellant's aunt, of Summer, in terms of who was there. They all indicated other people were in the house. They all indicated, you know, that there was, you know, a lot of activity there. Why isn't his testimony cumulative going to one of the other factors that needs to be met?
I think that's very similar to the impeachment argument from our position, which is that it's not merely cumulative. You had Mr. Knoyer, who testified he wasn't home, and Aunt Debbie testified she was home, but nobody has the specific information that Mr. Knoyer has. He testifies to things that no one else said or knew about, which are some of the things are that I was on the bus, AD was on the bus, her brothers were on the bus, and that's evidence that's new, and he testifies that the brothers were there all afternoon, and I don't think that Debbie or anybody else testified about that, or that Mr. Knoyer was in a position to testify about these facts. So I think on those facts, which are material in this case, that it's new evidence and it's not cumulative, and there may be portions of it that do corroborate or bolster some other testimony. But again, you know, we're talking about someone who's stating something based on his own personal knowledge and his own observations that, while similar to what some other people say, includes more evidence and includes important facts in this case, where, again, we're talking about a really limited time frame of only about 45 minutes where Mr. Knoyer was unaccounted for. And then if Kohlhoff, for example, would state, I think, if we look at his affidavit, that there were five people who got off the bus, there were five people who were home, which makes it almost implausible, if not impossible, that somehow AD and Knoyer were able to end up at home in this situation where we know Knoyer was at Walmart, It takes, according to Google, about 15 minutes to get home and then 15 back. So there was 15 minutes to commit this offense. And so I do think while some of the things he say are potentially cumulative, it has its own probative value by putting specific people in specific spots that would make this incredibly implausible. And I do think what Kohlhoff says is also corroborated to some extent by the Upper Mississippi records that were submitted, which show that there wasn't any treatment that afternoon. And where these people were and who was home is really a material aspect in this case, because despite what the prosecution puts in their brief about this being something Knoyer took great pains to cover up and to hide, I think AD's own testimony and her statements that were admitted as substantive evidence show that she talked about yelling and shouting and doors slamming and dragging through the house and being thrown down in the tub and all those things. And Kohlhoff has direct evidence that goes right to some of those things by saying, look, I was there. This stuff didn't happen. My room shares the wall with that bathroom. I can hear almost anything that happens in there. And if something like that did happen, I would know about it. And by the way, there's other people home. So I think
Mr. Longstorff, if I may interrupt you there. So it does sound like it's cumulative of the other testimony that you referenced. And as you acknowledge, it is for impeachment to try to impeach AD's testimony. But there's a third part I would like to talk about briefly, and that's whether this could have been evidence could have been obtained by the exercise of due diligence. We have in the record that there were a number of people that appellant provided and identified as witnesses that were that stated that they were in the house, that there are several people in the house. And those people also identified DC as one of the people in the house as well. There's testimony during trial about DC being in the house. If that's the case, how does this even qualify as newly discovered evidence when that information was out there before trial and during trial? And this is appellant's brother here. It seems rather implausible that they wouldn't have been able to reach out to him before trial or even during trial when this testimony came out.
I agree, Your Honor, I think it goes both toward the due diligence for the newly discovered evidence and also to a part of the interest of this exception. But what Mr. Knoyer has identified in this case that are factors that support reviewing his claim as satisfying due diligence and the interest of justice are that initially in this case, the allegations began as this was an assault that occurred in the morning. And it was in the complaint. It was in the search warrants when the initial witnesses, Barney and Janelle, were spoken to. And they were questioned about where are you in the morning, not the afternoon. So that's something that was an impediment or something that delayed Mr. Knoyer's ability to put together a defense. In this case, he was incarcerated throughout the course of trial on a conditional release violation, which played a role. So we contend that those are all factors which should be considered. And when we look at sort of the totality of the circumstances where Knoyer is relying on counsel and he's incarcerated and saying, well, you know, I think there are people who will corroborate that. Let's get them to testify that supports the due diligence and that he tried to get this done. It didn't get done. But part of that is the reason that it was set up as an ineffective assistance claim in the alternative, because if counsel knew or should have known that, then it was ineffective for counsel to not do it, which we also believe is in Mr. Knoyer's favor as far as a due diligence argument. And, you know, especially when a case like this with these kind of allegations, I think a defendant is fighting an uphill battle even before trial starts because of the nature of the allegations. And there's really an obligation to find every witness, anyone who would say I was home, or especially if they were to say, well, I was home and Kanoyer wasn't home. It's so incredibly important to have those people testify. And Mr. Kanoyer did want to have that happen. But the fact is that his allegation is that he didn't know what Kohlhoff knew. He knew Kohlhoff lived at home and Kohlhoff is his brother, but he didn't know that his brother had specific information about his defense. And the fact is that it really, if he had known about that, there is no chance that he would have went to trial without presenting it, which I do think it goes in favor of concluding that he didn't actually know about this prior to trial or prior to this. And so those are kind of the factors we believe that support his argument regarding due diligence and the interest of justice exception. Absent any questions, I don't have anything further.
All right. Thank you very much, counsel. Anything else from the panel? You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel?
Good morning. And first of all, can the panel and Mr. Longsdorf hear me?
Yes.
Thank you. May it please the court and counsel, I'm Dave Frank. I'm the Chief Assistant Beltrami County Attorney. And today I have the pleasure of arguing on behalf of the respondent, State of Minnesota. The post-conviction court did not abuse its discretion when it denied appellant's third effort at post-conviction relief in this case. First, the record makes clear that appellant's third petition is untimely, as it fell outside of the two-year filing period, which expired in the summer of 2018. The court further correctly concluded that appellant did not meet his burden of establishing any of the exceptions of the two-year statutory time bar. Appellant identified two exceptions, newly discovered evidence and in the interests of justice. Addressing that first matter, appellant did not show that the affidavit of his brother Douglas Kohlhoff nor the submitted scheduling records meet the newly discovered evidence exception to the two-year time bar. As Judge Reyes indicated, there are five requirements, and I'd like to go through each of them because I don't think that the appellant has been able to meet any of them. First, the record makes clear that the Kohlhoff affidavit, as well as the scheduling records from the mental health facility, really are not newly discovered evidence. When the court reviews the record, it's going to find that the victim testified that DC rode with her on the bus and was in the residence with her after she arrived home from school on the afternoon of April 19th, 2013. This is also reflected in the testimony of Summer DeMars, Rose Kanoyer, as well as the appellant. They knew Douglas Kohlhoff was present in the residence that afternoon, and that is adequately reflected in the record. So the appellant knew or should have known that Douglas Kohlhoff was present. And the court can look no further than the Kohlhoff affidavit, indicating that he was ready and willing to abide by a subpoena from the defense to testify. So it was clearly available to them. He knew that Douglas Kohlhoff existed and was in the residence during the afternoon of April 19th. So it really isn't newly discovered evidence. As to the medical records, Summer DeMars, the mother and guardian of the victim's brothers, testified that the boys were not at the therapist's office, as testified by the victim, but present at home when the sexual assault took place. So that information really wasn't newly discovered by the appellant either. But more to the point, the Kohlhoff affidavit, as well as the therapy records, could have been easily ascertained, which is the second requirement for newly discovered evidence by the appellant, certainly within the two-year window for filing a post-conviction petition. Again, focus on the proposed affidavit of Mr. Kohlhoff, which states that I was ready and willing. Nobody from the defense contacted me, and I was certainly available to testify at trial, and I was available within the 2 years after the a two-year time period started to tick. So that affidavit was easily obtainable, and because it was, the court can't use that as a basis for a new trial. The same argument goes for the therapy records that Mr. Longsdorf submitted. Summer DeMars testified that the boys were at home. They were not at their therapists. Summer DeMars was a favorable witness for the defense. Those records could have been ascertained through an authorization. Defense simply never attempted to get them until well after the two-year period has expired. Third, the Kohlhoff affidavit, as well as the therapy records, are at best cumulative to the trial testimony of Summer DeMars, Rose Kernoyer, Deb Kernoyer, and the appellant. In summary, Mr. Kohlhoff simply states that I was present at the residence. I believe that I would have heard a sexual assault. I didn't hear it. I didn't see anything. And as a result, the victim seems to be lying. But we already have that testimony from Summer DeMars, Rose Kernoyer, Deb Kernoyer, and appellant himself. At best, this evidence is accumulative. The court did not find the testimony of the witnesses that I just mentioned, appellant, his mother, his sister, and his girlfriend, and the affidavit from Mr. Kohlhoff really adds nothing to the record. It is cumulative. Same with the records for the therapy sessions. Again, we have Summer DeMars testifying to where her boys were on the afternoon of the sexual assault, which occurred in the residence.
Mr. Frank, on that point, in terms of it being cumulative, isn't DC's testimony actually contradictory to Summer's testimony? Does it even qualify as being cumulative of that testimony? Or the medical records, I should say, the medical records?
I don't see it as contradictory, Judge Reyes. I find it as consistent, the way I read the record. Summer DeMars states that they were not at the therapist's. And what Mr. Longsdorf seems to be suggesting is that the records corroborate Summer DeMars's testimony. And from my perspective, it is cumulative on that point as to where the boys were located during the afternoon of the sexual assault. Fourth, the Kohlhoff affidavit and the therapy scheduling records are offered for the sole purpose of impeaching the victim's credibility. Impeachment was at the heart of the trial defense during the trial. It was at the heart of the first appellate strategy, and it's been at the heart of the post-conviction relief all three times that appellant has made efforts to get post-conviction relief. The problem with the post-conviction strategy on attacking the credibility of the victim is that the statute precludes the court from considering new evidence that is used for the purpose of further impeaching the state's witnesses. Now, appellant in his brief claims that the proposed evidence goes beyond impeachment, but then simply goes on to argue that the proposed evidence is relevant solely to show that the victim is lying. That is an impeachment purpose, which therefore precludes the post-conviction court from using the evidence to grant a new trial. Appellant in his brief repeatedly asserts that the Kohlhoff affidavit shows that the victim fabricated her testimony. He repeats the same claim as it relates to the appointment records. Because the only relevance for the proposed evidence is to attack the victim's credibility, he cannot meet his burden of showing that the proposed evidence goes beyond impeaching witness testimony. Finally, as it relates to the newly discovered evidence claim, the district court correctly concluded that the appellant cannot demonstrate that the proposed evidence proves his innocence under the clear and convincing standard. Even taking the Kohlhoff affidavit as true, including his belief that he would have heard that a sexual assault occurred in the bathroom, it is not inconsistent with AD's trial testimony explaining the fear and terror that she experienced after appellant attempted to hide his brutal sexual assault by closing the door, covering her mouth. Look at page 18 when she describes how, when she attempted to scream, he covered her mouth so that no one could hear her screams. Appellants claim that anyone in the house would have heard the sexual assault, which was loud, mischaracterizes the victim's testimony. The post-conviction court does not review a proposed affidavit in a vacuum. Look what the court did with Henderson versus State. If other evidence of appellant's guilt remains, regardless of new affidavits, then appellant cannot demonstrate his innocence by the clear and convincing standard, and the petition fails. Now, at most, the appointment records establish that the victim may have remembered the whereabouts of her brothers incorrectly, but it doesn't do anything as it relates to impeaching her testimony in terms of what happened during the sexual assault. I would like to address the interest of justice claim by the appellant. I guess I'm going to disagree with the appellant on the appropriate case law to apply. The respondent requests that this court review the claim under Sanchez versus State and Caldwell versus State, which is the fourth time that went up to the appellate courts. The interest of justice exception is triggered by an injustice that caused the petitioner to miss the two-year filing deadline and not the substantive claims in the petition. This exception relates to the reason the petition was filed after the two-year time limit, not the merits of the petition itself. Appellant spends a great deal of time and effort addressing what he considers to be the merits or substantive claims, but he never articulates some active injustice that he suffered that prevented him from seeking his brother's affidavit or obtaining scheduling records for the victim's brothers. And as a result, the appellant cannot show either of the exceptions which he has brought forward. And this court should uphold the decision of the post-conviction court denying the relief without a hearing. I would like to address very briefly his ongoing claims as it relates to ineffective assistance of counsel. Those are NAFLA barred, plain and simple. He cannot get beyond the fact that the first effort at an appeal clearly addressed the ineffective assistance of counsel claims. Those were needed to be addressed at that time. Because they were addressed in his first direct appeal, they cannot be heard at this time. Unless there are any other questions, I yield the balance of my time.
Mr. Frank, I do have a follow-up question. I'm sorry, Judge Frisch, did you?
Go ahead.
Okay. Thank you. I did have a question on, you argue that the NAFLA bar applies, and I understand your position with respect to ineffective assistance of trial counsel. Are you arguing that the NAFLA bar applies to the ineffective assistance of appellate counsel claims as well?
I do, Judge Reyes, and that is because this is the third effort at post-conviction relief. And his first attempt at post-conviction relief went up to the Court of Appeals, including ineffective assistance of counsel. So this is the third time that he's bringing up ineffective assistance of counsel. These matters have been addressed. He's arguing about trial strategy. He's arguing about investigations. Those have all been addressed two prior occasions at the appellate level.
And I have one additional question, and that is with respect to the affidavit by DC in terms of, isn't there additional evidence, and we have to take that affidavit as true, but isn't there additional evidence of the fact that not only was he in the house, but he had a bedroom right next to the bathroom, and he stated in the affidavit that he could hear anything and everything that occurred in that bathroom by having the bedroom right next to it. That what seems to be different than what any of the other people testified to.
It's a little different, but Appellant claims that you have to take as true no one could hear anything, including the including DC. And I think his affidavit allegation is very broad. Clearly, DC believes that he did not hear anything. And I think you take that as true. But that is not inconsistent with the victim's testimony that the appellant closed the door and prevented her from screaming. I think those two statements are very consistent.
Thank you.
Anything else from the panel this morning? All right. Thank you very much, counsel. Mr. Longstorff, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it.
Thank you. I think, first, our contention isn't that no one else would have been able to hear this in the house, but the contention is that if Kohlhoff is believed, there are a number of people who are home, and this is an incident that began apparently with a finger being slammed in a door and shouting in the kitchen of a very small house over French toast or something along those lines. And so the testimony needed to be that no one was home in order for this have been able to happen completely undetected and for there to be no witness, independent witness to any part of it. And that kind of brings me to the next part of it, which is the evidence certainly does impeach AD, but that's necessarily because it has to, because there is no evidence other than AD saying this occurred. There isn't any independent witness in this house with 15 people. And if Kohlhoff is believed with 10 people who are home, at least immediately before this assault, the physical and forensic evidence is not conclusive proof that anything ever occurred, that there was ever even an assault. There were changes in the nature of the allegation. The timing of it switched from morning to afternoon. At one point, AD had argued or claimed that she had observed her brother being sexually assaulted, which just couldn't have happened because she said they weren't home. And then we know from the testimony from other people that they were gone. And so it's not as if there's some kind of conclusive proof that anything happened here. And in a case where literally everything comes down to a witness's credibility, of course, if there's evidence that this didn't occur from somebody who would say, well, I was there, my brother wasn't there, that obviously impeaches the witness and is going to be cumulative to any kind of defense that Mr. Knoyer put on. But I think the fact that it does impeach and it is a little cumulative doesn't mean that it's merely that. And as I was thinking about this newly discovered evidence exception largely mirrors the Rayner test for newly discovered evidence. And what I see in a lot of the case law in discussing Rayner is that this court and the Court of Appeals often say, well, is the evidence merely impeaching or merely cumulative? Which from Mr. Knoyer's perspective indicates that it is not just because the evidence does impeach somebody doesn't automatically mean that the test can't be satisfied. And so I think there does need to be that distinction. The Rayner test does that, but you see that at this court in a number of them, uses the term merely in discussing these things. And so I do think that that's an important distinction. And then as far as satisfying the can the outcome change, we have sort of a duality here. There's in a case that turns entirely on AD's testimony and credibility, if we have someone who says, Knoyer, I was home and my brother wasn't there, then this can't have happened because we're in this sort of unique situation where a lot of, criminal sexual conduct cases seem to be occurring over a long period of time or without specific dates. Well, this one, we know it had to be that day because Mr. Knoyer had been in custody until that night before, and then the kids were away from him after. So it had to happen on the 19th, and we have a real specific time frame. And I do think that where we have the witness, the complaining witness saying, well, it happened right after school, but before certain other people showed up, and then we've got someone who says, well, wait a minute, I was there the whole time. I know these other people were there. And then, you know, provides additional details such as, you know, it's a small house and I'm next to this bathroom. I know what goes on in there and I didn't hear any of this. That is something that if it were presented to a fact finder and if it were believed, can and does change the outcome, because both of those things can't be true. And as we're thinking about those treatment records, I do think that they're more supportive of what Kohlhoff says. And they do show that there was testimony that is or wasn't true at this trial. And those are the kind of things that Mr. Knoyer believes should be addressed. And he's asking the court to remand this for the opportunity to present evidence to support his claim. Absent any questions, I have nothing further.
Thank you, counsel. Anything else from the panel this morning? All right. Thank you very much, counsel, for your briefing and your argument. The matter is taken under advisement. We will issue an opinion within the statutory time period.